And welcome to Season 3, Episode 10 of Logicast, the AWS News podcast brought to you by Logicarta. I'm Carl Robinson, CEO and co-founder of Logicarta, and I'm joined, as always, by my colleague, lead cloud engineer, John Goodall. How are you doing today, John?
I'm okay. It's not Monday for a change, so we can't talk about the weekend, but I'm going to because I was in IKEA, and I love it there. Great fun. I know. Yeah. I bought some drawers for a Kallax.
Oh, did you have meatballs and chips?
Of course I did.
That is the best part of going to IKEA for me. It's the Swedish meatballs and chips. It makes it all worthwhile. So we're also joined today by a very special guest, Ran Eisenberg, who is an AWS serverless hero. How are you doing today, Ran?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Thanks for joining us. Tell us a bit about yourself, Ran, what you do for a living, etc.
Right, so I'm a principal software architect at CyberArk at the Platform Engineering Division and Serverless Hero, as you've mentioned. And I also have my own website, Run the Builder. It's like my brand, Run the Builder,
yeah.
Where I basically write about serverless, AWS, and technology in general, blogs, videos, things like that.
And do you also write about Lego? Because you mentioned Lego in our preamble.
Well, I mean, there's Lego on the wall behind you. That's
yes, oh, there is. Also in the room, pretty much around it. Yeah, around the room. Well, I don't write about it yet, but I do post sometimes on Twitter, or should I say X, from time to time.
Nice.
Do you glue those models, or are they just up?
No, it's like a special frame that has a Lego piece that goes into the car and then it stays on the wall. It's just a basic frame.
That's cool. Nice.
And yeah. are your children allowed to touch those models?
No.
No. Absolutely not. Yeah.
No. I don't think if they touch it and if it were to fall, I don't know what I would do. I don't think that I will have the time or the mental state to actually build it again. The red car is like almost 4,000 pieces, and that's way too complicated. Not going to do that again.
Yeah. And the big question is, would you be able to remain calm in such a situation, or would you just completely lose it?
I would lose it.
I think I'd start dissociating. It'd just be, just going to sit on the floor in the dark for an hour now and just recover.
Anyway, we're not here to talk about meatballs and Lego. As regular listeners to the podcast will know, once a week I curate a list of AWS news, which I share via my weekly AWS Roundup newsletter. And then John and I pick a subset of the articles from the newsletter that we'd like to talk about with our guests. So, of course, we have such a set of articles this week, all of them from the AWS blog this week, actually, from the various different blogs that AWS produce, or from the AWS New Feature Announcements website. And the first one is indeed a new feature announcement about how AWS Lambda has improved responsiveness for configuring stream and queue-based event sources. So I'm going to come to you first on this one, Ran, because I know you had some opinions to share on this. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, at the beginning, they said it in some cases or in some events, Amazon DocumentDB, MQ, MSQ, Kafka. To be honest, I haven't really used them, but they said that changing, disabling, or deleting any connection to Lambda from those sources would take up to 15 minutes, which sounds pretty much horrible, to be honest. But now it's 90 seconds, which makes more sense. Ideally, I'd like it to be like less than 10 seconds, but from 15 to go to 90, that's much an improvement. But to be honest, I'm much more excited about the other thing that is mentioned in the article, which is the Event Bridge Pipes connection, which now also has this improvement. And I don't know if you guys have ever used Event Bridge Pipes. Have you before?
No, I know of them. They get bandied about various serverless meetups I go to every so often, but I've never had need.
Yeah, so it's a relatively new. It wasn't in the last, it wasn't, they were announced not in the last reInvent, but in the reInvent before that. And it's basically what it does, it connects a source, a single source to a single target, and you can filter events, you can enrich them, can transform the event, and it's a managed service, right? It takes the events from the source, does the manipulations, sends it to the target, and handles the retries to the APIs, authentications or whatever it needs to do, retries, failures, whatever. Great solution. The problem was that for almost a year, it was pretty much impossible to debug it. So if you had a problem and it didn't work, there was no way for you to really know other than having a custom metric that would appear only every, I don't know, 1 minute, I think. And it would say, hey, you have an error. But what is the error? We don't know. We never know. So lastly, I actually used the service and I had to guess and I got it to work and it was amazing. But then at reInvent, I wrote a blog post about it and said, hey, you got to have more options to debug. It's really impossible to use it. To reInvent, like it was 3 months ago now? Already 3 months ago. So
time flies.
Yeah. They announced the ability to have the debug. So now you can actually debug all the process from the source, filter, enrichment, failures. So now we can actually use it, and I totally recommend it. So it's a very underrated service. So people should definitely use it, especially now with connections to DocumentDB, Amazon MQ, MSK. Sounds perfect.
It's a funny one, isn't it? Because Amazon AWS, more specifically, have this history of putting out services that are not quite finished. And then they kind of, a year later, they kind of end up being usable, and then they've kind of tarnished the goodwill to an extent, I think, which goes against their principle of putting out. Well, you might remember this, Carl. It was a couple of years ago now, we were at an event, and it was Amazon's culture of innovation, and they put out, it wasn't minimum viable, it was minimum something, minimum lovable product, I think. And it's like, well, it's hard to love anything when it's not done.
I think user experience is super critical. And I think that the feedback that they got from the community will make them not repeat the same mistake again. I think that if they want to have more people using new services, they got to have these kind of basic, pretty much, it's really basic.
Yeah.
Basic it's user an odd experience thing. Sorted. Yeah.
It's an odd thing to just go, there's an error. We don't know where, though. It's okay. Thanks. You get this in a couple of other places. The other place I've come across it, and it's not event perhaps at all, a bit of a tangent now, is if you register a custom type in CloudFormation, because what happens there is that actually deploys to a Lambda that's owned by the CloudFormation team. You do it in Python or JavaScript or whatever. And if that errors, all you get out of CloudFormation is internal CloudFormation error. Cool, thanks. Can I have a log file, please? Like, tell me what failed. But yeah,
custom instances are tricky, but it's really up to you, the one who writes it, to make it usable. I mean, they just provide the framework. You need to figure out how to make it work and how to debug it if that fails. That's why it's called custom. But I do agree that it should have more. I don't know, better framework for the custom resources to enable you to debug it properly instead of reinventing the wheel when you build it. Yeah.
Well, it's great to hear that these improvements have come about and that these services are indeed now a little bit more usable from a user perspective. Let's skip along to the next article for this week, which is an article on the AWS Cloud Operations and Migrations blog, which has got a very long title. So let's see if I can read this.
Have you got your teeth in?
My teeth are in here. Let's hope they're not going to fall out while I try and read this title. So it's an article on the AWS Cloud Operations and Migrations blog entitled Streamline Platform Engineering Using AWS CodeStar Connections with AWS Service Catalog. So I have to admit, Service Catalog is something I'm familiar with. CodeStar, not something I'm familiar with at all. But what are your thoughts on this one, John? Perhaps you want to give a few definitions first before we dive in.
Yeah, okay. So CodeStar was used a little bit actually at the AWS Dev Advocates on Tour, the European thing that they did last year, which was just so funny because the London one was the first one. It didn't get a lot of promo, and they had this kind of event space that wasn't an Amazon office, and it was they had like space for 100 people and 9 people showed up, which is just brilliant. But yeah, so it featured a little bit in the DAs on tour, which was interesting. It was kind of their answer, I suppose, to GitHub. Was they didn't use those exact words, but that was the vibe. It, you know, it had a way of doing pipelines, it had a way of doing camber boards and issues, and it integrated, I think, with Cloud9, the IDE, and it was their answer to GitHub effectively, but they didn't actually say that because presumably that's against brand guidelines. Cool, wonderful. Service catalog is effectively, as I understand it, a set of pre-rolled CloudFormation templates, and you can use other templates, SAM, CDK, if you like, that deliver functionality. And you go, here's my catalog, here's the things I can deploy, bump, which gives platform engineers the ability to pre-roll things for consumers of that, which is much more applicable for very large organizations than the ones that we typically work with at Logicarta. But it's one of those, like, people I've worked with before, you know, the big oil and gas folks, that kind of thing, they were using this sort of thing because they say, well, you as a developer should only be able to do these sorts of things, so we're going to pre-roll that for you so you don't have to go away and write it. You just go deploy, job done. That's fine, that's excellent, we like that. Obviously, you want to keep those sorts of things in source control, and you want to be able to deploy it out to your various accounts from, say, your central management account or your designated administrator or what have you. And that's kind of what this is talking about. It's basically saying that now there's a way of connecting GitHub repositories with service catalog products. So you can say, this product is backed by this repo, bink, and now we do our updates, and we get this GitOps process where we've pushed up and it becomes updated and it's available. Cool. Okay. Cool. I'm very not the target market for this. I'm the sort of person that would be going, oh, for crying out loud, why are we having to do catalog? Do we not trust our people, really? But that's what this is for, I guess. It's interesting that they're banging on about it now. And what I find more interesting, though, is the connection options, as you can see, as you kind of go down screenshots and things. The providers are Bitbucket, GitHub, or GitHub Enterprise Server. Weirdly, not code commit. Okay. Or GitLab, or just generic Git. That'd be nice. But okay, cool. Yes, we connect to GitHub, we install the app, and then you've got this nice connection so you can make your changes and push it all through, and it all kind of looks lovely. Okay, thanks.
What are your thoughts on this one, Ran? I know you had some opinions to share.
Yeah, so since I work at the platform engineering division, we actually use it. And I do agree it's more fitting for a large enterprise. We're like 3,000 people. So it's more about than just trusting the developers. I would say it's about governance and basically making their lives easier. So in the end, it's service catalog allows you to have a portfolio of products, and then you can deploy these products in all your accounts, right? And our customers, basically, the internal teams, the developers, and we can do that to basically help them connect all sorts of products, right? It can be like we send our logs to Datadog. So from CloudWatch, we send it to Datadog. So instead of them having to deploy something and maintain a GitHub repository that does whatever we need to do, like a Kinesis firehose that sends to Datadog, we can do it with the portfolio. And it's really nice because they don't need to manage code. They just manage the product. They deploy it. And if we add the new products, they gain access to it automatically. So it really streamlines everything. It's really simple. And another very cool use case that I'm actually working on a conference talk about is that you can basically automate service to service authentication, like cross account access with a service catalog. Because if you have multiple accounts, you have different roles, you need to gain access to the other account. Usually you do it by assuming a role in the other account, things like that. And somebody needs to create these roles and make the policies, the IAM policies, to make everything connect. So service catalog is a great option for that. So it's a great service. Now, as for the article itself, I wasn't aware of CodeStar, to be honest. And when I looked at the console of the service, it says that it's going it's going through sunsetting. So in July 24th of this year, you're not allowed to create or manage projects. So I'm not sure. So we have like 4 months, I guess, to use this cool new feature in the article. I don't know. The timing is quite odd. But to be honest, I think it raises a more serious question, maybe a security question. So usually when you want to publish a product, we do it by publishing to a GitHub repository, and then the portfolio team, they pull the artifact, they make some tests, and they create a pull request where you update the version to use the new CDK or CloudFormation template and to publish the product. So the direction is GitHub to AWS. Now it's kind of going the other way, like the portfolio is getting updated automatically, right? If I read it correctly. And you need to, so your AWS account needs to gain access to your GitHub code, which is seems like an odd, maybe potential.
That's pretty well trodden in the other code suite products, like Code Build, Code Pipeline. That's pretty well trodden.
Okay. Sure. So anyway, service catalog is useful. I'm not sure about CodeStar in this connection, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a funny one. It is, as you say, if it's being sunsetted in 4 months, like, well, what was the point? And
why are you blogging about it? Maybe they're hoping that, get a few more people using it and it won't be sunset anymore. Salvage it. Please use my product.
It's rare for AWS to do that, though. It is. I can count on one hand the number of services that have been killed. It's about 3, I think. So, yeah.
Get the other hand ready. Get the other hand ready. You might have to go to the second hand.
Shocking.
But it is very rare. It is very rare, and it's one of the things that the blog post that we co-wrote, the one that I'm taking the credit for, about choosing a cloud service provider, it was one of the things that we mentioned in that article, actually, when comparing AWS against some of the other big cloud providers who do tend to sunset services on a much more frequent basis. So let's hope AWS are not going in the direction of some of the competition and going to be regularly sunsetting services that people are using, particularly this one where they're kind of promoting its use as it's in the sort of the latter months of its life cycle. So
I wonder if it's just if it's being pushed from the service catalog side rather than from the CodeStar side, and they've gone, well, we've added this thing, but we don't really care.
Perhaps, yeah, because I guess service catalog is not going anywhere.
Nope.
So anyway, on that note, let's move along to our third article for this week, which is also from the Cloud Operations and Migrations blog. And this one is all about how you can accelerate troubleshooting with structured logs in Amazon CloudWatch. So we've already touched on logs or lack of in certain cases. So logs, of course, critical to troubleshooting errors in your applications. Ran, I'm going to come to you first on this one. What are your thoughts on how you can accelerate troubleshooting with structured logs?
So I think the article is pretty good. It basically talks about best practices, so to speak, with CloudWatch surrounding logs, metrics, and traces, and then the cool log insights and some AI-generated queries that you can do in... in CloudWatch, you can use... You basically run the queries to look for logs and things like that. And they added some AI dust where you can use natural language to basically generate these queries. So that's pretty cool. I think the entire article just pretty much sorts everything together, that you should write JSON logs because JSON has the different types, data, integer, string, and it keeps these types, which makes it easier to index and then to search for them in the logs and use them as metrics, which is great. Pro tip, you can use libraries like AWS Lambda PowerTools. PowerTools for AWS Lambda. It does say Lambda in the name, but the logger part, which is an excellent logger for JSON structure logs, right? Yeah, you can use it anywhere. It doesn't have to be a Lambda. So you can use it in your container. And they support, I think, 3 or 4 languages. So it's not just Python. It's
7, I think, now. I think it's 7. But yeah, it's, yes, definitely a plus one for the Lambda Power Tools. I'm a big fan of Power Tools.
Not just Lambda ones. You've usually got some on the workbench behind you.
Drills are over there. They were, in fact, used when putting the IKEA furniture together. So...
You needed a drill.
Well,
something must have gone wrong if you needed a drill with IKEA.
It's a combi driver drill impact thingy. Right. It was for screwing things in because I don't want to hurt my delicate and dainty wrists.
Make sure to turn the torque right down. Otherwise, yeah, just tear through that chipboard. Yeah. Anyway, we digress. Back to the Lambda Power Tools.
Yeah. I mean, for me, CloudWatch logs, unless you take a very deliberate approach to them, horrible. If you just start throwing log messages out and try and query them through CloudWatch, through kind of logs, they are awful. You can't find a damn thing when you're looking for it because it's not been indexed properly. It's not been structured properly. So you have to take a very deliberate approach to logging in a way that you probably should have been doing anyway, if we're honest. But if you're, lazy or like me and come from a server world where you're used to just big streams of log files coming out of things like Nginx, you're not used to having to worry about it. It's just kind of there. So it's important to be deliberate. And it's nice that they've sort of gone through and say, so what is it? Here's what it's useful. Here's kind of how you do it. And then you can use things like CloudWatch Insights. And CloudWatch Insights is quite cool because you can set a collector account, I think is the term, where you can actually query the log groups from every account in your organization from one place, which is brilliant. And you're not having to port logs around and move them and replicate them and all that kind of thing. You can sort of go from one place and query against every stream that you've got available, which is nice. But the structure and the deliberate approach is absolutely necessary.
Yeah, I think that specific feature where you can view several accounts in one location, that has been missing from CloudWatch for several years, which is a pretty basic feature in all the other, like Datadog and Grafana, things like that, where you just pour all the logs into their SaaS account and you can view everything together.
Yeah, it was always a big selling point of throwing logs to an external service is you can say, depending on how you've got your workloads segregated, of course, but you can say for all of our production workloads from our 10 different production accounts, they're all over there and we can go and look at them and it's all fine. And you end up with this, particularly with Datadog, you end up with this very spendy approach because you're paying $7 a gigabyte or something stupid. I don't even know what it is offhand, but it gets very spendy very quickly. So... yeah, the fact that this, and it doesn't talk about it in that, but the fact that, with Log Insights, you don't have to do that anymore. That's quite nice.
Yeah. And again, with the AI features where you have, when it builds the query for you, it gets much easier to build it because the query language is not easy.
No, it's not the most intuitive thing. Yeah. It's not.
But it works. I mean, it works great. Now with the AI, it should be a much better experience.
We managed to go 23 minutes and now we're talking about AI. That's a record.
I was just going to comment, actually. I think AI dust was mentioned at about 21 minutes. So, we normally don't get that far into an episode of the podcast without mentioning AI these days because it is just everywhere. It's all good. On that note, let's skip along to the next article for this week, which this one is on the AWS database blog. which is not somewhere we take articles from on a regular basis. So nice to see databases featuring on the podcast.
It's because it's got serverless stuff in it. It's not the database.
Yeah. Well, it says Lambda. So the fourth word is Lambda. And we all love serverless. So great. This article is all about how you can trigger an AWS Lambda function from Amazon RDS for MySQL or Amazon RDS for MariaDB using audit logs and Amazon CloudWatch. And that was an even longer title than the previous article. And I'm very pleased with myself for getting through it with with my teeth still in. And I'm going to say it again, because I'm going to ask you, John, all about how you can trigger an AWS Lambda function from Amazon RDS for MySQL or Amazon RDS for MariaDB using audit logs and Amazon CloudWatch. Why would you want to do that? And what are your thoughts?
Well, it depends what you're looking for, but the audit logs are basically a record of what's going on in the database, right? And that's useful for certain scenarios, security being an obvious one. Query logs are kind of in that area as well, but it's here's what's gone on and here's why we care about it. What the solution is doing, and this diagram is, I think he's using the up-to-date icon set card. I don't know, you tell me, that's your area.
Looks good to me. I'm not seeing any legacy icons there. I get, just for Rand's benefit, I get very annoyed when I see AWS solutions architecture diagrams with legacy icons that aren't the latest icons from the toolkit. It's just something that kind of upsets me on a regular basis.
But yes, this very up-to-date diagram is basically, it's pretty simple. I like these sorts of diagrams. It's RDS, slinging them out to a log group in CloudWatch. Brilliant. Okay. There's a subscription filter on the log group. And what that is basically saying is I am reading the whole log stream that's coming through. And if I get an event that matches this filter, which is the same sort of thing that you do for alarms and metrics and things as well. So you can say, you know, I can build an alarm based on this log because I've seen this in my log group. And then the subscription filter is piping out to Lambda because Lambda is subscribed to the log group via the filter. And then we've gone, oh, I've got an event I care about. Lambda, do a thing. That thing might be go off and investigate automatically and see what's gone on. It might be grab the offending or the matching transaction details from the database, pop that in an audit table somewhere, and then notify someone so they can go and investigate and say, by the way, we've had this thing go on. You need to go and look at it. I mean, it's not something that you see hugely often out of databases, and maybe you should, but it's certainly something that if you look at the CIS benchmarks, that you do an awful lot of that kind of thing for CloudTrail. So it's just kind of an extension of that process where you're monitoring your infrastructure for things that you need to know about and then doing something with that information.
Any thoughts on this one, Ran, yourself?
Yeah, so when I read the article, I was missing the why. I mean, it just says, hey, this is how you do something. But I didn't understand the motivation. It's a really well-written article, takes you step by step. But I didn't understand the why, because maybe for an auditor, when they want to look at logs, maybe suspicious activity, things like that, I needed the article to say that. So assuming that that's the reason, it's a good article, but I think I'd make a change. So eventually, the main part is basically getting the logs to CloudWatch to get written to the log group. That's the main achievement, I think. So that's pretty well made. Once it's there, I think if it's a database with a lot of, you know, many writes, many reads, maybe triggering a Lambda function is not the best approach. Maybe you can send it, connect the subscription filter to a Kinesis firehose, like, and then from there you work on a batch of logs, then you can send it to an S3, Glue, Parquet, whatever. You can do whatever you want with it, right? But I think instead of the connection to the Lambda, I'd use Kinesis firehose. But overall,
yeah, it depends on scope, doesn't it? It does. It depends on scope, because your subscription filter should be filtering down to the lowest possible level anyway. But if your subscription filter is out of necessity fairly broad, then yeah, you want to think about batching.
I agree.
I think really the go on, Ran.
No, I'm done.
I was just going to say that the Kinesis has been dropped from the firehose now. It's just
Data firehose.
Right. Okay. They renamed it.
You saw Mateus talking about that in Glasgow or Manchester or wherever he was, Northern, didn't he?
I think that's probably why I know that, from Mateus on my LinkedIn feed. So
now we're going to have to tag him. Excellent. Yeah.
But also I feel like this you've just given yourself another blog post idea there, Ran, to blog about your alternative solution to this particular challenge, and maybe start with the why, because it's always important to start with the why. Why would I need to do this?
I actually already wrote about it. I have a blog post about exporting logs from CloudWatch to an external like Datadog Grafana, and this is an example. I have the Lambda and I have the Kinesis.
Nice. Well, maybe you should drop that in the comments to give an alternative to the readers of this article. Anyway, on that note, let's skip on to the final article for this week, which is on the AWS Smart Business blog. That's a new one on me. I don't know if it's a new blog, but I've never come across the AWS Smart Business blog before. This article is all about how to do a cloud cybersecurity checkup for your SMB in 2024. I suppose you could have done it in 2023, and maybe you you can do it in 2025 as well, but it specifically states that it's how to do it in 2024. Perhaps there'll be new tools, new exploits, etc. next year to worry about. Then it goes on to offer some benefits, checklist requirements, and more. So, Rand, given that you're in the cybersecurity space, I'm going to come to you first for your thoughts on this article.
It's a really good article. I think it covers the basics of, first of all, why you should care about that, and if companies, small companies, need to really understand why, then they already have a problem, because this should be something that they care about from day one. But I also think that unless you have security is a profession, right? People are professionals and they do it 24/7. So I think the article also mentioned that. So unless I think you're going to do it 24/7, or at least you know what you're doing, like this is your job, I suggest that small, medium businesses just outsource it. Just pay for somebody else to do it for you, pay the professional, they will do the checkup, they will set up whatever they need to set up. And there are companies, right, they do that. They set up whatever you need to do. Secure your identities, secure your passwords, firewalls, whatever you need to do, just pay for somebody to do that for you and make sure that you're configured. Because it's a whole philosophy. They go on into the article and say how you should manage your AWS organization, what kind of security tools you should use. I mean, they just say this is the tool that you should use, but they don't tell you exactly how you should configure it, how often should you use it. There's so many, details, right? It's a whole world. So unless you have a person who's going to do that 24/7, it's going to work on that, just pay for somebody else to do it for you.
I mean, to be fair, at the end of the article, they basically say that, because they sort of go, here's all the things that you can do. Leverage our AWS certified experts to secure your business. And then that links through to the cloud IT experts in the SMB blog in the Smart Business Hub. Okay. So it's here's a thing on what SMB should be doing. And SMBs are historically quite bad at this because, I mean, we certainly see this in our customer base. And I've seen this in places that I've worked before as well, where the primary goal of the engineering team in an SMB is features, 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 get the product out, make money, make money, make money. And then it's worry about how much it's costing to run. And then maybe security comes third, which it shouldn't. But if you've got, three developers and half a platform guy because he's a freelancer, then it's not top of list, because it's all well and good. This is paraphrasing. It's all well and good being perfectly secure, but we need the money first. So I suppose this is the point around outsourcing. And we make this point in sales pitches and stuff as well. It's outsourced to someone else so that you can worry about the things that move the needle for you. Pay us and we'll worry about this kind of donkey work backend stuff, if you like.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, Ran, that security is a profession. And I think a lot of people are tempted just to think that, we just need some tools. But tools in the wrong hands are pretty useless. My garage is full of tools that that I don't know how to use properly, or perhaps have never used. I've purchased and have just never used those tools. And I think that's often the case that, business owners think, if I have a tool, I am protected. But, tools in the wrong hands without that knowledge, without being in the profession and knowing how, the appropriate selection of tools, and then once you have the tools, how to actually operate those tools and what it is you're actually trying to do with them, that's often the part that's lacking in these scenarios. So, if you think that your business is protected just because you bought a tool, think again. I think it's worth saying. So
you should pay for this tool instead.
I'm glad you said that, John, about yourself. And it's not something that I said, because that would have been inappropriate. So, But on that note, we have reached the end of our time for this week. So that was season 3, episode 10 of Logicast. Thank you, John, as always, Goodall, for your insights. And thank you very much, Ran, for joining us today to share your insights with us as well. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast. As I say every week, if you've enjoyed the podcast, tell your friends about it. We are available to download from wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to see what we look like while we're talking to you, we're also available on YouTube for you to watch. That was season 3, episode 10 of Logicast. We'll be back next week with another episode for you. Thank you very much for watching. Goodbye.